We are not heroes, nor are we villains, neither kings nor magicians, but we can tell you their stories, for we are the Lore Keepers, and we welcome you to Hallowmay. Those of us that survived the destruction of the world grew jealous of those that hadn't. When the ashes cleared and the skies returned to us, no longer could we see the vault of arcane sea above. No longer did we feel it course through our veins, nor flood the sorry and pale reflection of the world that once was. We were promised the garden, but our inheritance is the dirt. There is no magic left to sustain our souls. Before these years of dark, we heard the whispers of your laughter on the wind. In the rainstorm, we felt the comfort of your embrace. In the rays of Yadiel, we were warmed by the pride of your smile. But now nature has turned against us. In the sunlight, we are scoured by bright hot hate, peeling the skin on our backs. We cower from incessant gales, whipping about us in a mad cackle. The rains nearly never come, and when they do, they beat at us, washing away our towns, our lives. But who are we to you, O Regent of Song? From what set of dry and cracked lungs do these words of woe come to you from? Can you even hear my heart from there? We are those that survived. For centuries we did as you led, O Muse. We have looked after humanity, first of Own's creation. I wonder, can you even see them anymore? Can you look upon the beasts they have become? No? Then I will tell you. Our flock has become twisted. They envy, they lust, they fear, they hate, they kill. These passions, foreign to us in the land of our eternal youth, have shackled the hearts of humanity. They fare better than my kin, for humankind know not of their changed nature. My people, the Fae, created by you to lead humanity, we know of our loss. We remember just enough to know the corruption in our hearts. Yet by a cruel twist, for this very reason of our knowing, we are greater thralls, more consumed by passion. We did the best we could to keep them sane. We rationed portions of our own virtue, of our own blood, and sprinkled it on their masses. It is nothing. To their thirst, O Muse, it is as a misty dew on cracked ground. And still they rage, tormented by their own passions. You proclaimed we were to stand in the gap, to mediate between the gods and humanity. Would you still decree such, I wonder, when you cannot even hear their cries? When the whole of the heavens are deaf, dumb, blind? And what of us? Do not the shepherd and shepherdess deserve nourishment too? Are we forbidden some small comfort when our need is truly greater? Muse, where are you? I have been faithful to you all these years. Others defied you. Others cursed you. I refused. I had faith that you would open the heavens, that you would come save us from our dark hour. My brothers and sisters called to me. They said, "Come and drink. We have found nourishment in our flock. Come and taste of their blood." I said no. Though in my heart I longed to feel as they did. I have no more answers. I have no more answers, nowhere left to turn. And so I turn to you. If you do nothing, I fear the monster I shall become.
Greetings and welcome to Helame. You are listening to Lore Keepers, a lore building podcast where we explore eons of history, heroes and villains, and the forces that whirl about it all. I'm Frank, one half of our small crew, and what you just heard was a prayer to one of the regents of the Nine Flow, one of the gods of the heavens, Muse. It was given by an elven priest during the era, the Avum Secunda, second era. It was a time of great darkness. It's a time where that we're actually about to explore. We will look into some of the first large impacts of the Ash Curse, which we discussed in the previous episode, the sort of fall from creation, if you will, especially as it pertains to the very magical creatures, elves and dragons. We hope you enjoyed the last episode. We're still working the kinks out in the audio, so bear with us while we nail things down. And if you're interested in getting in touch with us, and perhaps you've got stories of your own you'd like to share, or maybe to just comment, or whatever it may be, stay tuned to the end. We'll tell you how you can do that. But until then, why don't you settle in, and Carter will lead us into our discussion of elves, vampires, dragons, and, well, human slavery. So enjoy. Or do you have kind of a good grasp for how we want to begin?
What is a Dargon? And where do they come from?
What are Dargons? That's a great question.
And what do be Dargon do?
What do be Dargon do? The dragons and vampires. Yeah, that's right. This episode is going to be about dragons and vampires.
Not exclusively, just mainly focusing on these two topics. We might dip into a few others, as is our wont, given our tangents.
Yeah, we'll try and keep it focused, but my goodness. Dragons and vampires. I gotta be honest, as a person who never really went through a goth phase or, you know, any of that shit, I've always appreciated dragons from afar and thought vampires were kind of interesting, but more from, like, a lame political, like, what they represent politically than actually the fact that they suck blood and are passionate creatures. And I don't know. Putting them into my fantasy, it seems odd that I'm putting these two as like, hey, here's our episode two, but it actually works out really well, and it explains a lot about the consequences of the Ash Curse from sort of a heightened view.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I've always enjoyed vampire stories, and I'm a big fan of the old dragons, so...
Oh, well, yeah, you got all that black lipstick you keep on applying, Carter.
Yeah, I mean, don't judge me, man.
Oh, I don't judge. I am jealous of your velvety lips. It's frustrating that when I put on my black lipstick, I can't pull off that sexy pale look that you've got. Well, I guess actually they probably have like blood red lips.
I mean, you know, it depends on how the vampire wants to go about. They're people just like we are. They just happen to be typically extremely evil and desiring to feed upon the basically essence of other things.
Yeah, which, hey, that's not a bad segue into our topic, segue. Did you know that that's how that's spelled? Segue is, or segue is actually spelled S-E-G-U-E.
Don't spell it, me.
Yeah, I always thought it was spelled literally like the two-wheeled future thing. Oh, no. What have I been doing?
Frank, I'm sorry, but we need to talk about vampires now, so get off
your
segue.
Right. So, yeah, okay. So, the significance of vampires and why they even matter, we kind of need to step back a second and refocus on the Ash Curse. Right? So, the Ash Curse happens, and things get bad. To remind people who maybe this is their first episode, a little bit of a recap. The Ash Curse is the equivalent of, in the world of Halume, in the Halumian cosmos, that is their term that refers to the mythological equivalent of the fall, or humanity becoming mortals, or whatever your equivalent is of that. But it's like in the Bible, leaving Eden, or, you know, being tempted by the snake. So that happens.
I thought the biblical allegory there was the war in heaven.
You know what? That might actually be a better metaphor for it, or better. I can't think of the word. I can always set it up in spaces here. Better allegory. Yeah, that's a better allegory for it. Because wow, I actually never even made that connection. But I'm kind of mashing two events. The result of the war in heaven, if you will, from the Nameless One, who is sort of the devil figure, the equivalent of Satan, they take out their vengeance, they take out their wrath on creation through destroying the magic, the arcanosphere around the planet Sidar. Sidar was this sort of beloved creation of Own, the maker god, and was seen over by the major gods, the regents, as sort of a younger sibling. And when it got hit, it destroyed the arcanosphere, destroyed most life on the surface, and as a result, the Nameless One was banished from creation. But that's actually a really good point, because the one of the crucial differences in this mythology and in sort of the mythology of the Bible is the fact that in that story, it's humanity that chooses sin, whereas in this one, it's more that imperfection is thrust upon them by the devils. So that happens. So that's a good point. But the Ash Curse happens, and humanity, the first of the mortal races, is heavily affected, as are the Fae and the progenitors of the dwarves and gnomes and halflings. So there's three major races at the time. By the end of the Avum Secunda, we see a lot more than that, but at the time, that was what was on the planet. So Sidar gets hit, and everything goes pear-shaped, like, really badly. Like, 90% of life is destroyed. When the ash finally clears, after over a century of being pummeled and the skies are darkened because of volcanic activity, thus the name Ash Curse, people are left imperfect, whereas before they, because of their innate access to the nine flow, they have a sort of divine balance between different ideals or hopes and dreams. The way that they act and behave is no longer balanced that way. In fact, people are lucky if they have much of a soul left after all. Humanity is not immortal. Even from the beginning, they had longer lives than they do now. They were shortened considerably, as were the elves and the progenitor for the, I guess I'll just call them the Dosumai. I don't know if that name's ever been dropped to your ears, Carter, but cat's out of the bag now.
I've heard it.
Okay, well, cat was out of the bag and was prowling around the apartment for a while then. So the Dosumai get hit, the elves get hit, the humans get hit, their lives are shortened, but the main thing that happens is that because of the soullessness of the races, they start to suffer. At the time, everyone's pretty much benevolent. The Nameless One is pretty much the only example of a being that has shown malevolence in all of creation, and they have started to taint some of the Ethereum, the heavenly realms. And not only that, but they also, as a result of their actions, but not directly because of it, allowed for imperfection to enter the material world, the Materium.
Yeah, and we're really focusing on, especially with, you know, the vampires portion, the elves, right? It's the elves that really have this vampirism that comes about.
Right. So without getting too far into it, without having to go too far back to describe where they came from and their origins, the elves that we know today as high elves, little footnote here, but like the reason why I did a lot of this stuff is I wanted the world I created to be very compatible with D&D. So you'll see a lot of overlap with that kind of stuff. But the elves that we know as the high elves today are descendants of a very specific sect of elves that discovered ways of recharging or reaccessing magic from the time when it's lost. So when the Arcanosphere, when the Arcane Sea gets cut off and no longer feeds into Halime, that isn't the end of all magic, because people still can store magic kind of like batteries or cisterns within themselves. And in the same way, there's certain topographical, geographical, especially rocks and rock formations, but also life of every form is capable of holding small batteries of magic. Okay, so elves were originally created as a hypersaturated reflection, positive reflection of humanity. So they were given a greater portion, greater capability to cast and perform magic. They were smarter, faster, more capable. And they were gifted to humanity by the gods through the creation of Illuvium, a sort of, you know, this oversaturated mystical fey world as a positive reflection of the Materium. On the first day of the first century of creation. So they get created. They are made by the gods to basically be mentors and guides to humanity, to lead them and aid them and be emissaries, specifically ambassadors, you could say, on behalf of the heavens, as being sort of this mediator creature. With that responsibility in mind, the elves and the humans start to build a relationship during the golden hour, the time before the Ash Curse, of a very positive relationship of sort of mentor and student, guide and learner, the seeker and the one who has found. As a result, there's a very trusting relationship between the two races. This episode, we won't really be focusing that much on the Docimi, so you can put them out of your mind for a little time here. But basically what happens is, after the Ash Curse, this relationship begins to get corrupted. At first, the elves in their entirety, trying to do damage control, they say to themselves, how do we take care of our people? Because they're basically the leaders of all of mankind. They're seen as what we would consider kings or queens, or magistrates, emperors, etc. Any sign of authority or royalty, that's the position that they carry. And when they get hit with the Ash Curse, being in these positions of authority, they see it as what we could think of as an ideal government, one where people of true benevolence are seeking out the favor of their people and trying to provide for them. So they're faced with this intense crisis for a long time. For the first 100 years, they are essentially rationing magic, and they're looking for more ways to feed the people, to give them life and soul and hope in the midst of literally a gray sky darkness that is raging over the world. And they continue to try and do this because they are seeking humanity's favor. And some things start to happen that make it more problematic. For one, the bestial nature of humanity starts to take over, which means that insecurities about fear of the future and other things cause people to start to act erratically. And in order to prevent that from overtaking things, you know, they continue to administer this magical ration, if you will. The places that they're drawing from are largely their own souls and from cisterns that they have built or discovered. But eventually, those dry up, and they don't know where they're going to get more mana to provide for their people.
So what's going on here is we see the elves trying to take care of the humans, and so the humans are getting the magic that the elves get. And I suppose at one point the elves might look upon their human subjects and be like, I really need some magic. I'm feeling a little bit dry. I mean, I've been helping them out for a while. Now I think maybe it's their turn to help me.
Exactly. So the more desperate that they get, the frustration of it is only increased by the fact that humanity, their generations are much shorter and they grow in population at a much quicker pace. So the elves are faced with more and more mouths to feed, more and more people, and the stress just continues to climb. And as they drain their own souls, they too start to, you know, lose their connection with what we would consider humanity, but, you know, a sense of
virtue.
Yeah, virtue. Exactly. So they lose their, they start to lose their virtue or their capability of being able to access that virtue. And those two things together, the stress of having to have many mouths to feed and the numbers only growing, and the fact that they are losing access to like just true unimpeded virtue, means that the elves start to get more and more frustrated and glowery and start to blame humanity for this dearth of this lack of magic. So yeah, they start to look to other sources and they secretly begin to perform different experiments. First with creatures and plants, they discover that they can start to draw energy first from plants. And this is very problematic because at this time, the clouds have lifted, but most vegetation is gone. And so anything that they'd be trying to draw mana from is food that could be eaten. And in this case, the elves are not necessarily herbivores. Some of them are. They're probably more herbivores among the elves than there are among the humans, but it's not like a...
They're not
averse.
Anti-meat.
Yeah, they're not anti-meat. They're not averse to eating the flesh of an animal. Yeah, this happens. They discover that they can start to draw mana from plants. Then they start to wonder, hey, maybe we can draw mana from animals instead. And they figure out that, wow, these things are like batteries, and they draw from them. And then they take that a step further. Maybe we can draw, if these things, which have a very, very low level of sense of virtue, have mana in them, what would it be like to try and draw mana from a creature that is capable of sentience, of being among the races that are considered the knowing? And so they start to draw from humanity and literally pulling it from the blood. And this is how blood magic is discovered. And so vampirism develops, but it doesn't develop in the way that we would typically think of vampirism, like in the extremely, you know, physical, practical way of like sucking the blood and stuff like that. It's more like it begins as a draining. But as the people are more and more heavily affected, as the elves are more heavily and heavily affected by doing this and the loss of the virtue and the drinking deep, it doesn't actually resolve any of the inner conflicts of their selves, because the magic of the time is tainted and corrupted. The very nature, the way that they're trying to draw it is faulty, because they're basically taking somebody else's personality and adding a fragment of it onto themselves every time that they draw, which makes them more and more corrupted and more less and less like themselves and more like a shattered reflection of everything that they've ever consumed.
It's like they're giving themselves dementia or something.
Exactly. Yeah. It starts to create a level of insanity, of dementia among them. And all this time, humanity has grown so used to depending on the elves for provision for life, because they're barely able to stay human themselves because they have so much of a smaller ability to, you know, store virtue within themselves, that they are like sheep led to a slaughter.
Is this the kind of first enslavement then?
Yes, so this is kind of where enslavement that the elves enact over humanity begin. They start to justify, this is the only way to take care of them, this is the only way to manage them. We need payment. We can't just keep doing this for free. This is not a handout. This is not how empires or kingdoms work. And this, eventually, after a couple thousand years, still very, very early in the era we call Avum Secunda, creates the Shrouded Empire. Shrouded because most of humanity doesn't know what goes on in the dark halls of kings and emperors and queens and what they get up to. But it and starts
also shrouded as a, you know, the historians of the later years don't know very much about what's going on as well.
Exactly. Exactly. There's a lot of history that's lost there, especially elves who are ashamed of their past. They limit the knowledge of this. That fact of slavery, which only the current era, if I refer to the current era, I mean Avum Quintus, it's the Fifth Age. Only about one era prior was humanity freed, finally, from slavery. Up until that point, they were considered slaves and not among the knowing races for that entire time. They were refused language and being taught. The elves were the primary enslavers. There were other races that took part, but by a much smaller extent, mostly because they just didn't have that same history. But some twisted reflection of what the elves believed was necessary to protect and take care of humanity. They basically saw them as beasts that would run themselves into ditches, if psychological or philosophical ditches, if you will, if they were not taken, you know, quote unquote, taken care of by their masters.
But this doesn't apply to all places all over Sadar. It just applies as a general rule, right?
Yeah, so that's, yes, at least on the continent of Everast, which is where most of these histories and these perspectives are focused, that is the general disposition. And that's not held by all elves, but it was also something where maybe a good frame of reference to think about it from is like 100 years ago. By then, it was like, yeah, slavery was, you know, not favorably looked upon, but not everybody was considering it to be a important enough issue. I'll say it this way. Before the Civil War, not everybody was a slaver, but not everybody was an abolitionist. That's probably the cleanest way I have of saying that.
Yeah,
that
you don't want to dig yourself too big a ditch in United States history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's. I'll leave it at that for now. But basically, so yeah, all of that happens, creates a whole lot of issues, and vampires as they're known today basically come from the twisted progenitors, or elves that just became very twisted from sucking the blood of their subjects.
So is that all we want to say about vampires?
I'm trying to think of, I don't know, what else would you want to say about them? Was there anything else? I guess we could talk a little bit about the Shrouded Empire.
Let's talk a little bit about, like, maybe vampires today, given that, you know, they look similar to what one would normally think of as a vampire, right? And right. They're not all exclusively elves.
No, not at all. One last thing I'll throw in here. So I mentioned before, this is where high elves came from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically, the academic, the more sort of knowledge is beauty, it creates complications or like a difficult past where, you know, there's some issues in trying to justify where you came from or where your wealth came from, because oftentimes it can be traced back to, you know, having a lot of slaves that work for you for nothing. But so vampires in the current era, they throughout history, they kind of take different shapes and forms. But basically, it's because after all of that information had been destroyed, all of the references back to the Shrouded Empire, people started to discover and recover some of that information. There was a period where vampires were completely done away with, and they no longer had access to their ownership of, you know, all of humanity. They kind of disappeared due to a few different things that we won't get into right now. But the modern vampires basically rediscovered this ability to apply blood magic and modified it in ways where it could be taken more directly. Sort of, you could think of the difference between, you know, I don't know, snorting cocaine and mixing it into something and injecting it into your bloodstream, something like that, where it's, you know, it's more, not a great metaphor, but yeah, sure. Something more direct.
I got a great metaphor for you. Drinking alcohol or fucking sticking it up your butt and drinking it that way.
Yeah, something like that. It turns out that I don't think that can actually make you drunk. Oh, no, never mind. That's a different thing. But yeah, it's like, how desperate are you to get your high as quick as possible? Especially because that same fragmenting of the soul still holds, still happens.
So Dargon's now?
Yeah, so Dargon's now. Now, how this relates to the dragons is that the dragons also had a position, a role of responsibility and caretaker over humanity and the other knowing races. They specifically were made before the elves, long before that, as sort of macro scale guardians. There was many less of them, and they were more just about having an incredibly powerful... For as powerful as all peoples were at the time in their ability to use magic, dragons were essentially purely magical beings. They were only tied to the material realm by the loosest threads and basically a shell that, you know, they could exist in. Their dragon-like form was literally just to hold just pure magical power. So if you think that, you know, elves or humans are powerful, a ancient dragon that is thousands and thousands of years old, you know, if they could, they could create worlds at a will. So, which is basically what they were made to do. Their job was to, the division between the two, being metallics and chromatics, that's, you know, I'm straight up pulling that from D&D, but the metallics, their job was to look after the world, the earth, sort of the physical side of things, the non-living waves and winds and the elements. The chromatics were given the peoples. All living things were under their purview. Metallics are, you know, they were meant to seed the world with value, and they, like, basically would discover and find precious stones. But yeah, so a similar thing happens, right? The chromatics during the Ash Curse lose access to lose access to magic. And that heavily impacts them. And it impacts them far more than the metallics do. Their relationship with humanity is much, much stronger because of their guardian position. The metallics have a more distant relationship. They're at this time, at the time during the Golden Hour, they were more distant forces of great power that represented kind of like avatars of natural forces. And if you saw one, you know, heading overhead, you knew that either weather was on its way or that something significant was about to happen in sort of the natural realm. But chromatics were positioned in civilization itself.
So is it the kind of the same thing that happened with the elves, that, you know, the chromatics had a responsibility to these knowers, and so gave away their power, and it drove them crazy in a similar way? And this is why the metallics didn't have this problem, is because they kind of just slept it off?
Close, yeah. So that's the general gist of it. More specifically, the metallics, due to the fact that they were about purveyors of... They had discovered that... This is kind of an odd little thing, but they discovered that gems and jewels make for great gizzard stones for literally processing food. This was something that, just due to their more solitary nature, all dragons are relatively solitary, but the chromatics interacted with each other more frequently. Due to their solitary nature, they would discover these gizzard stones and kind of keep that to themselves and hold on to it. And what they didn't know is that those were absorbing their latent magical energy, whatever they didn't use in you know, a span of time, was stored in these stones. And then when the Ash Curse hit, they had those to live off of for thousands of years. Obviously, it came in trickles, in small amounts, but it was something. Whereas the chromatics, when they got hit, their connection to the magical realms was entirely... Like they were a part of a river, I guess. There was no storing up of energy. They had just complete, you know, they had access to the people around them, and they had access to the nine flow, and they basically just acted as a pipe of thoroughfare. So they had no ability to store that stuff. Their solution was very different from the elves. During the time when the elves are still suffering and trying to figure out a way to provide for their people before they dived into blood magic, the chromatics decided that they were if they were to go, if they were to lose their ability to perform magic, that they could destroy the world. And so their leader, which, what did we decide her name was?
Oh, this
did we decide it was
me.
The Quintessence?
That's a
the
title.
The Fivefold Empress?
That's the one.
Okay. Their leader, yeah, the Fivefold Empress, the equivalent of Tiamat, if you will, basically made a call. She said, we can't stay around here. We're too powerful. We're going to destroy all of creation. We're going to destroy these beings that are, you know, these mortals beneath us if we stay around, because we've already seen creatures, you know, there were already examples of chromatics who had eaten people for a desire of just feeding themselves, and, you know, before they were healed, and, you know, magic was shared with them so that they would, you know, kind of get their virtue back. So what they decided to do was to leave. Straight up leave the world. To fly up and into the arcane sea in the skies above and just depart from the planet. And so for the people of the world at the time, this was perhaps even more painful than the Ash Curse, or painful in a different way, because beyond even the elves, the dragons were the sigils of hope, the stanchion of the possibility of a future. If these powerful creatures said, no, we can't be here anymore, regardless of their reasons, then we are truly fucked. Like, we truly have no out, we have no way of surviving this world, and so the chromatics disappear. And for hundreds of years, they are gone. All of humanity is left without hope, and they travel through the darkness in the skies above. Stories are told about them, but nothing, no hide or hair. Well, they don't have hair, but no hide is ever seen of them.
Hide or scale.
No hide or scale. Yeah, exactly. In this time... Oh, go ahead.
All right. You want to fill in the time, because my question is going to be, well, when do they come back, and why are they just crazy as hell?
Well, that's a great question. We'll start with this. In the intervening time, the Metallics see a gap in open, like a hole where basically these people are hopeless, right? And so they try to approach humanity and take care of them, but they also weren't really made for this job, and they're not really sure what they're doing. So they're pretty far off. They're pretty, you know, their minds aren't geared to understand civilization the way that they understand the natural world. That was what the chromatics were literally made to do. And so they kind of lack the judgment to understand whether what the elves are doing is considered moral or immoral. So as all of this stuff is happening, the dragons are basically just fooled by the elves. The elves continue to tell them lies about, we're just doing this. Or if not lies, justifications for their actions. And the dragons are basically thinking, well, we didn't spend 1,000 years in the golden era, you know, when minds were perfect, understanding how civilization works, so we'll just trust them. You know, they've been guiding humanity this long. We'll assume that they're doing the right thing, even if it looks a little weird. There are times when they intervene. There are definitely points when there's some battling between the Shrouded Empire and the Metallics, but it's more skirmishes than anything else. And because the elves have the advantage of true access to magic, they are able to kind of put a one over, hold their own, put a one over the Metallics, and you know, trick them in a way where they just trust the elves.
And like, is the Hearth King taking point on this?
The Hearth King, basically, who is the leader, the Platinum Dragon, sees all of this and, yeah, is somewhat taking point, is somewhat, you know, taking a presiding role, but is also dealing with a lot of sadness and just pain because of the fact that the Fivefold Empress is gone, and that was his
consort.
Yeah, his consort. That was his mate, and so like for the first time, he no longer has access to this this being whom he trusted a lot to try and figure out, A, how to guide humanity, and B, how to take care of the world in its entirety. The world is in balance, and the dragons are a slow-lived race. They take a long time trying to figure that stuff out. So, after a while, the chromatics return. And they are not the same things that left. They are changed. Somewhere out in the darkness, somewhere out in the space in between points of light, in constellations and in the stars, something changed about them, and they come back monsters. They...
Idea.
Oh, yeah? You got what? Lay it on me, mister.
Nameless one. That's it.
Oh, you're thinking maybe there's some sort of interaction there?
I mean, I think if they go off and they can't get back to the, you know, the Immaterium where magic is, and they're just fucking running around, they're like, you know, what do we do? You know, maybe one of them stumbles across a font of power that is just beyond their reach, and they try to reach it, and maybe they somehow contact He Who Has No Name.
Well, I don't want to say too much, but you're definitely on the right track, Carter. I will leave that history for another time, but yeah, something akin to that. They discover a power, a way to survive out there, but it changes them. They come back different monsters than as they left. Literally, their bodies are mutated in ways that they shouldn't be. And this really, really fucks with the world in a bad way. Because for the last forever, humanity has been telling stories of these guardians who have been, you know, who have meant to take care of them, and how, you know, in their current plight, and, you know, the elves are doing their best or whatever. But what we really need is chromatics. That kind of sentiment was happening a lot. And then they come back and they're monsters, and they start eating entire nations and destroying the whole world. And immediately the Metallics know, okay, well, this isn't right. And they start to fight back from the chromatics. They're basically, if there's one thing that they know, it's other dragons. So thus begins the Drakenfall, which is this war between, you know, war of the dragons between the two sides. Those who were left changed irrevocably, and those who were left unchanged. Unfortunately, something that the chromatics have on their side is the Dragonborn. This is where the Dragonborn come from. They were taught, we'll call it a secret, they were taught something, some way of creating humanoid shells of themselves that lacked a mind and lacked a soul, but were capable of complete and perfect obedience. So each dragon, you know, would have thousands of Dragonborn under them that would act as shock troopers, basically using the weapons of humanity against them. You know, a dragon can't really hold a sword, and while being a dragon is a pretty great way to win a war, a better way to secure it is to have troops that you can order around. And if they're perfectly connected to your mind, which the Dragonborn were, that just puts even more power on it. And so this immense force has basically no way to be stopped and starts to just completely sweep. And so the Shrouded Empire faces, you know, among all of the other, you know, things that are going on, specifically the Shrouded Empire is the largest cohesive civilization at the time, and they face extreme destruction as a result. There's not really a solution that they have for any of this, and things are looking pretty bad. So how does this all wrap up? How does, you know, what happens that fixes this situation? Well, basically the chromatics, they're dragonborn shock troopers. The Metallics, in their war against them and fighting back, kind of convene together with the Hearth King. Name pending, we might change that depending. It's kind of weird to have an empress and a king, but we can hold on to this for now. The Hearth King basically decides we have to destroy our brethren. We have to destroy the chromatics, or at the very least banish them. And they found that they didn't have the heart to do the former, so they did the latter. And they banished the using basically the last of their reserves, the last of what they were capable of in terms of casting magic. They banish all of the dragons from this plane of reality. There's not really any clear record of where they went after that point. They just know, it is just known that they disappear from the world, which leaves the Metallics and the Chromatic Dragonborn. And with the last of their power being drained, the Metallics become little more than beasts themselves. Many of them kind of struggle with flickering in and out of reality, barely even able to hold on to their corporeal form, which if they lose it, they basically become just like pure mana, which just disperses like a gas, but, you know, let's call it a really explosive one. Since the last of their power is drained and they're basically left living on, you know, drips, they are watching their, not brethren, but these creatures that are, you know, mindless and soulless, moving about, you know, similar to everyone else, like animals, and can do nothing about it. And that's kind of problematic and creates a lot of pain and sadness. But the Metallics are not the greatest heroes, honestly. They could have done a lot more. They weren't really capable, or they doubted it, or they made justifications. But at the time, they failed humanity in some pretty spectacular ways. And they saved it. They did. They figured out ways to pull it from the ashes. But there was it came at an extremely high cost.
And maybe this is kind of why in the latter ages we see Metallics taking a more, active role in the defense of you know...
The knowing?
People.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly where that's going. It's basically, during the return, the Hearth King basically sees all of this and for the first time is himself again. After all of the suffering that people went through, the undying king of the dragons experiences magic again. So there's something called the return, which is basically how people rediscover and figure out a way to get magic back into the world, and it heals the land to an extent. Whereas during Avum Secunda, everything is pretty much a barren desert that looks more like Mars than it does, you know, a terrestrial world. There is a resolution that's figured a way of healing the planet, a way of healing the world. And when virtue begins to be restored to creatures, the dragons, seeing what they have done and seeing how they did not, how they failed the knowing when they had basically taken on themselves to take care of them, they vow that they will never again abandon the knowing. They will never again cause so much hurt because of the lack of their guidance. And they basically begin to study and figure out how exactly to take care of the people.
And what about the Cro-Mads? Do they ever come back?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they come back. But I think that might be a story for another time.
Okay.
So we're starting to get on in minutes here. Yeah, needless to say, the Cro-Mads come back. The Metallics and the Chromatics by Avum Quintus have both disappeared off the face of the world, and nobody knows why. So whether they kept their promise is kind of up to your interpretation. And that is certainly, I think we might have just a dragon episode to talk about some of that stuff, because my goodness, there is some history there.
But, you know, first I have to know about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's some seals that need to be broken campaign-wise before I can reveal some of that information. So maybe we'll come back to that sometime.
But we could do a nice little addendum talking about... So there are many varieties of Metallics, right?
There are five, yeah. There are five Metallics and five Chromatics, five types.
Yeah. And given that, you know, they have their... There is a separation... Then there's, given that there's five varieties, they're different varieties, right? Obviously, it would seem to make sense that the varieties were given different roles.
Right, yeah. So, yes, that is totally true. The bronze have a different job than the copper, or brass have a different job than silver and gold, etc. Same is true for black, white, red, green, blue.
You want to talk about that, or you think we should save it for the Dargon episode?
I think we might have to save it for a later episode, because I haven't specifically designed that stuff yet.
Okay.
I think that that's a... I'm actually excited at the opportunity of... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what they do. That's a great question. We should definitely talk about that a little later.
Yes. And also, the whole reason why we said Hearth King and the Fivefold Empress is because she was something else. We could call her the Fivefold Queen or give her another title.
Yep.
And then when she came back, she called herself this Fivefold Empress.
Right. With the little knowledge, sanity, sentience that she had left, She was calling herself the Empress because the Chromatics, their blood boiled out in the darkness, and they demanded that each of them be given a position of rulership, ownership, power. They craved being worshipped or known as powerful beings. And so as a result, she said, this is of our nature. This is how we are. This is what we deserve. And if that's the case, then I am the Queen of Queens. Thus comes the name the Fivefold Empress. Thanks for reminding me of that. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, no problem. It's my job.
Okay. Honestly, I think we're probably close to wrapping it up here. I don't know if there's anything else we want to talk about.
I mean, we talked about Dargons and we talked about vampires.
Yeah. Box checked that, and yeah. Checked.
I mean, I don't know what else there is to say, really. The magic leaving had a lot of problems. These are just two. There's a lot more, you know, like the whole desert thing.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, boy. We can definitely, I think we might have a whole episode just devoted to either the Dosamai or the Veldt, or talking about kind of how people figured out ways to survive during Avum Secunda.
Besides sucking other people
again,
off.
Perhaps. Yeah, yeah, might have to come in at a later episode. Thanks for listening to episode 2 of Lore Keepers. We hope you enjoyed, and if you did, feel free to drop a 5-star rating in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you receive this podcast. Let us know what you like, what you didn't like, and Carter and I are just excited because there's so many more stories to share in the world of Halume. If you've got a story that you want to share with us or you want to reach out to us, you can reach our podcast through our Twitter handle at 1000 icons. That's the number 1 followed by the word 1000 icons. Or if you just search for Lore Keepers, you'll find us that way. We're also pretty active on Reddit. If you look for by the same username, 1000 icons, you can find us there. Contact us through that. We kind of creep through the world building subreddits and D&D behind the screen and all sorts of stuff like that. So if those are some shared haunts of yours, feel free to contact us that way. I want to thank Josh Silker for use of his song Land of Heroes. Did a fantastic job. That's what that opening stinger is. So until next time, don't worry. There are always more stories to tell in the world of Halume. See you next time.